Okay.
So, Dr. Norman Pollitt.
Right.
Real one. Mm. And if I could ask you, first of all, Dr. Pollitt, about your background before the war, if you could give me some idea of your family and the sort of lifestyle you had. We're really trying to discover what made you a pacifist.
Yeah. Well, it's a long time ago, of course. 40 years plus. And I was thinking about it the other day. I had an ordinary sort of middle-class upbringing and went to an ordinary county school. But I think possibly the first pacifist ideas, very elementary ones, must have been produced when I was about 7 or 8, waiting in a nursing home to have my tonsils out. And the only things I could look at while waiting were, I recall, some Illustrated London News journals, if the Illustrated London News was about then, I'm sure it was, and they were running a series, I think, on World War I battles, and there were very vivid pictures of soldiers bayoneting each other and so on. Not photographs, pictures, illustrations, because the Illustrated London News had a very good lot of artists. And this, I think, you know, possibly in the old subconscious, stuck around for a bit. But anyway, one didn't have any serious ideas about pacifism until after I left school. I was a normal schoolboy, I think, fighting with the rest of them. Though I was more bullied than acting as a bully myself. And in 1934, I suppose it must have been, I left school with what was then known as a matriculation. And because the country had just come through its difficult economic time, my father, of course, was most anxious to get me in a good, safe job. He himself was self-employed somewhere in the city, and obviously had a tough time of it. And I, at that age, 16, didn't know what I wanted to do with my young life, so I was more or less told that I should get a safe job, whatever it was, with a reputable company doing whatever. And as it happened, there were some members of the family who were in the insurance world, life insurance world. So after, I think, an initial phase of a few months in a building society, of all things, sticking stamps on envelopes just to fill in some time while the family worked on finding a job for me, I eventually, I think, in 1935, that was when I was 17, joined the Pearl Insurance Company and worked in the head office in High Holborn, still sticking on stamps and taking post round, as I recall. But after a couple of years there, one naturally moved up to more important clerical jobs, and I was persuaded, I think, to start doing the professional insurance examinations. There were no particular pressures at home in any sort of way pushing me one way or the other into a career as such. I think one was just glad in those times, in 35, 36, to have a job at all.
Wondering, were your family religious? Were your family religious at all?
Not overly so. Not overly so. I was baptised, I have a feeling, in a Methodist church. I'm not at all certain about this. My memory is a bit short for that that date. I do remember going religiously, if I can use the word, to Sunday school and so on, and taking part in the school services. But I don't think the family was really, could be regarded as a strictly overtly Christian family. We didn't have born-again Christians in those days. But, you know, I was brought up in a very, fairly rigid sort of family life discipline. You didn't do this or that or the other because it just wasn't done. They didn't say it wasn't the Christian thing to do. But during my time at the office of the Pearl in London, I did meet, I think, in 38 or thereabouts, several young men who were quite interested in what was then known as the Peace Pledge Union, the PPU. And I think early in late 38 or early 39, I was persuaded to sign the Peace Pledge Union document, which, as far as I recall, says something to the effect that I renounce war and resolve never to support or sanction another. I think that was probably the wording. And I signed this. Now, I remember after signing it, the fellow who I knew very well, because we'd had several discussions about this, he said, "Right, Norman, thanks very much. Next time we'll meet will be when we're facing the firing squad." So, it's a little bit dramatic. There it was.
It's interesting you said you were persuaded. So did that mean that, you know, there was any pressure put on you to do this?
No, I don't think there was any.
Were reluctant?
No, I don't think there was any pressure, because at that time, 38, of course, Munich and all that, was a lot of talk of the possibility of another European war. And call-up, conscription was being mooted. I think conscription first came in May 39. But obviously these things were being talked about in newspapers and on radio. We didn't have much television then. When I say persuaded, let's say that I joined in with the group, as it were. It was a sort of peer group, and one or two of us, felt this was the thing to do. There was also a very admirable actual Quaker, a fellow named Stan Smith, who I thought was a splendid chap. He put out some of his Quaker views on peace and war, and I thought this was an interesting aspect. And I couldn't see myself in a soldier's uniform clutching a rifle with a bayonet on the end of it and sticking it into somebody else. That's a very simplistic view. Someone once said to me, "Yes, the pacifist idea is all right for the individual, but for a nation it isn't right." I was inclined to disagree with that, because at that time, of course, we had all the troubles in India, where Gandhi was doing very well with his non-violent resistance, and indeed right to the end. I mean, it was non-violent resistance that would chuck the British out of India. So I knew that for a nation perhaps pacifism might be the idea. Non-violent resistance was the thing then. Anyhow, having signed the PPU, when conscription came along, I thought, well, I can't go back on this. Discussed it with the family. They said, do you really want to do this? It's quite the right thing to do. I remember having a very heated argument with one of my uncles, who had served with distinction in the 1418 war. My father had been in the Pay Corps, incidentally. I forget where my uncle had been. But he was dead against it, and one or two of my father's business friends, I think, were dead against it and were quite objectionable to me after I had mooted the idea that I would be be a conscientious objector. Anyhow, having made up my mind, I don't think I waited for the conscription papers to come through. I honestly can't remember, but I know that I appeared before one of the tribunals. This was at Fulham, and this was in February 1940, in front of Judge Hargreaves and his colleagues. And I remember feeling absolutely elated after this, because you're put in a sort of dock, really, and one had to make a statement as the reasons why you refused to accept the order to be conscripted. And that is when I think I brought in my slightly religious background. I said I was brought up to, as a Christian, and to follow the teachings of Jesus Christ, and so on. And I had two supporting individuals, one, I think, from the office, and one who is still a very good friend of mine, living out in Australia now. He, I think, also supported me that extent. So with this statement, plus the two witnesses saying, in effect, this chap, in all conscience, cannot be made to go and fight, one went along to the tribunal, and after the what at that time I think was a fairly grueling interview with this doc, with the public were there as well, but there was no, you know, heckling or anything. Nothing was thrown at me. I was given conditional exemption. The condition being that I should either go in for agriculture or do some sort of ambulance work. It wasn't quite worded in that way. I was looking for it the other day, but I don't seem to have got the original document, which is not surprising. But some sort of ambulance work. In the meantime, through my Quaker friends at the Pearl, Stan Smith in particular, I had discovered that the World War One Friends Ambulance Unit, people had been connected with that, had mooted the idea in the meeting for sufferance, I think it was called, suffering, that it would be a reasonable thing to do to provide an outlet for pacifists in the world in World War Two, if war were to break out, as indeed it was imminent, along the lines of the World War One unit. So I had heard of the FAU and had written in saying that I expected to be given exemption at my tribunal, and would they consider me as a member? And I met two or three of them, Peter Hume and one or two others were mentioned in the book, and was accepted provisionally at the training camp later that year, provided that I'd got the necessary exemption. And that, of course, I did get, and I joined the training camp in Birmingham in April 1940. That was only 2 months after the tribunal, so it all fitted in very well indeed. And that, of course, was a totally new experience to come from pushing a pen with life insurance policies and proposal forms to living in converted cow sheds in a farm in Birmingham, getting up at 6 in the morning in shorts and singlet, and running round some vast lake in the grounds of Dame Cadbury's beautiful house there, and then coming back exhausted to breakfast. It was a totally new life, and one met there, and I think there were roughly 50 of us in that camp. This was camp number 4. Roughly 50 of us. Men from all walks of life. I mean, some were straight from school pretty well, some from university, from various backgrounds, from one or two working class backgrounds, but basically I think we were from lower middle to upper middle class background, but a very good mixed bunch. And one had this common idea, and
You were talking about the sort of people there and how most of you were lower middle class on upwards.
Well, no, I said, no, in fact, there was one or two from the... No, I said one or two from working class, as I remember, and then we were just a mix from the lower middle and upper middle classes. You know, so you can divide the middle class. So there were none of the aristocracy there, let's put it that way.
Yeah. This led me on to wonder, you know, do you think in your experience that... pacifism is related to social class in any way?
No, I think pacifism is probably an intellectual idea. And I, insofar as you can relate intellectualism or just simple intelligence to class, which I think you can. This is why I think most pacifists have come from the middle class. I hadn't thought about it in that way before, but it does require thought. I mean, you have a gut feeling about it, but it does require a bit of thought, because people then put the argument about what do you do when this German chap comes along with a bayonet in his hand and threatens to rape your mother. And the answer is, of course, you react like anyone else does on an individual basis. But here we're talking about wars, which most of us in, or those of us in the unit in 39 and so on, this last war, before we learnt about the nasty habits of the Germans, regarded it as purely a political expedient, and that wars were created by politicians, and that if everybody got together and said, no, we will not fight, we will not join the army, we will not have an army, then there will be no wars. And that's the ideal situation. But as is pointed out to everybody, the weaker always get sat upon by the stronger. So you have this terrible paradox that you have an arms race, you build up, because you've always got to be the stronger person in the sense of a stronger nation. I mean, I think it's... I don't know what I'd do if the situation were to arise again. I mean, I think it may sound glib to you when I said, well, I just signed this thing, this PPU thing, etc., because it was there. But in fact, one agonized a good deal about what to do. You have on the one hand the fact that everyone, should you do what everyone else is doing because they're doing it that way, or should one stick out with one's idealistic ideas? And pacifism is an ideal. And is there a place for idealism in the modern world or in a warring world? On the other hand, you could say that if nobody sets up the ideal, then there's going to be nothing for the future generations to learn. So I think it's a terrible, terribly difficult decision to make. And one will never know whether it was the right decision or not. Because how do you define right decision? From my point of view, it was a fortuitous decision because it led me into doing something which perhaps I would never have got around to doing had I stayed, had I gone into the army and hopefully come back to the office and ploughed into the insurance business. Okay, I might have become a managing director or something, but whether that would have been a particularly satisfying life, I just don't know. I think it probably wouldn't. Because there's certainly, going into the unit certainly aroused an interest in medicine and medical treatment. And had I not been in the unit, I would certainly not, I don't think, have been able to take up medicine as a career. The interesting thing is, I think, as you well know, that after the war there were various government schemes to help people either get back into careers which were interrupted or to start off in new careers. And there were government grants available to help people do that. And although I decided after I'd come back from Ethiopia and when there was a possibility that the war might end in 45 or 46, I'd already decided that if possible I would like to do medicine properly, because in Ethiopia we were just sort of doing a bit of sophisticated first aid, if you can put it that way. Made that decision in my own mind. It was inhibited by the fact that I realised that this would obviously cost money, and my father wasn't all that well off, and how would I do it anyway? But being then 20-something or other, little problems like that didn't bother one over much. But it must have, I suppose, at the back of my mind, been a bit of a stay. However, towards the when we could see that the unit would eventually be disbanded, at that time, I think this was after the end of the European War, at that time the government was then talking about establishing a procedure for awarding grants to people wanting to continue a career or to start up a new one. And after making preliminary inquiries about whether conscientious objectors would be included in the government scheme, and finding that nobody knew the answers, I and one or two of my friends in the unit who thought likewise decided the only way to do it was to suck it and see. So we got application forms and put them in to the appropriate department. I think I remember in my case there was an initial turn down, not any reason given, and I then lobbied my Member of Parliament saying that although I hadn't been in the armed forces, I had put in 6 years in the unit doing work here, there and everywhere, and would they didn't he think that the appropriate department could reconsider? to reconsider they did. I had an interview, I remember, with a very understanding civil servant up in Whitehall somewhere. He said to me, well, he said, this is a bit outside the rules, you know, the regulations refer specifically to the armed forces. He said, but there's always a way that we can bend the rules slightly. So I did, in fact, get a grant. This was conditional, of course, on getting into medical school, which was difficult in those days because there was a tremendous post-war rush into all sorts of professions. And it was quite difficult to get into medical school. Just like that, yes. Mm. Yeah. But, however, after applying, I think, to 3 or 4 medical schools and being interviewed by 2 of them, I finally got into St Mary's Hospital at Paddington and qualified in 1952 in the minimum time that was needed to do that. Had I not been a pacifist and a conscientious objector and not joined the Friends Ambulance Unit and had the experiences in it that I did have, I would no doubt not have been fortunate enough to get into a profession which I very much enjoyed being a member of, and hopefully have done some good in some places to some people some of the time.
Right.
That comment. Some good.
So now it's the FAU. You've explained, you know, how you went to Northfield and some information about the training. Mm. How about the training for medical work there? Do you know, did you do anything at Northfield itself?
Oh, yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. The camp, as I recall, the Northfield camp, the fourth camp, went on for 6 to 7 weeks. And the training we had there was basically to train us as ambulance crew. Additionally, we were trained to look after ourselves in the sense that we were taught to cook and to do housework, those of us who hadn't done any before we came in. But basically the training was in first aid and ambulance work. And we had a splendid doctor there who'd come in his spare time and teach us all the first aid we knew, culminating in the standard first aid examinations of the Red Cross and St John's at the end of it. And you had to get the certificate no matter what you planned to do in the unit anyway. So basically the training was for ambulance work. Now additionally, the powers that be, the committee that was running the unit, realised that there was more to it than that, and that we could be of some use actually in hospitals as porters, orderlies, nurses, telephone operators, clerks and so on. So we were given the opportunity in Birmingham of working in the Birmingham hospitals, which we did in small groups of 2 or 3. We'd work on the wards with the nursing staff. They thought we were something very peculiar. But we went round and made beds, emptied bedpans, nourished the sick, ran messages for the matron and so on and so forth. So we got a good grounding in hospital work at the training camp. After the training camps, by then the unit had set up very good relationships with hospitals up and down the country, hospitals which had room to keep us, accommodation for us, and spare capacity on the wards to do ordinary nursing. And we were shipped in loads of perhaps half a dozen or so to places like Gloucester, Bristol. I remember particularly I went down with a small group, I think of 6, down to a little known hospital down in Orsett near Grays, and there we did all the nursing work that was required. There was plenty of work to do, and we were accepted as being slightly odd individuals, but but nevertheless I think they were grateful for the extra pairs of hands that we offered. We helped in the theatre, we helped in the X-ray department, but it was all basic training for, quote, medical work, unquote, in the broadest possible sense. Then, of course, after that, after the first few months, after leaving the training camp, which I think must have been in May or June, and doing some of the hospital work in Orsett, I was moved up to the unit's sort of second headquarters in London. The unit was really divided into three parts. There was the training camp in Birmingham, which went on pretty well until there was no one else to be trained. I don't know how many camps we had, 10, 11, 12 at least, probably in the book. We then had an administration office in Gordon Square, which is just off Gower Street. I think the block itself that we were in is no longer there. It's demolished. It's right by the University of London there. That was the sort of administrative headquarters. And then we had another group based on the, not on the, in the, based in the students' hostel of the London Hospital in Whitechapel. There was a Quaker physician at the London Hospital, Dr. Henry Wilson. In fact, there were two Quaker physicians, Henry Wilson and Michael Vasey, both consultant physicians at the London, and they were extremely helpful in finding us work, not only in the London Hospital, but in hospitals attached to the London Hospital itself, out in the various sectors. Because the idea had been that after training camp, we should have a body of, say, 50 chaps fully trained in ambulance work who could then get the next Channel ferry to France and start work. But, of course, there was the months of the phony war and then the collapse of France, so the opportunities to work overseas were just not there. And trained unit personnel were coming out of the camps at a rate of knots and having nowhere to go. Nowhere to go abroad, that is. So we were dotted around the country, as I say, in various hospitals. And the London Hospital was the biggest of this. It so happened that the students at that time moved to the country, evacuated. The full-time medical students then were evacuated from their beautiful hospital behind beautiful hostel behind the London Hospital, and we took this over absolutely lock, stock and barrel, and we needed it. I mean, it was very nice. We had individual rooms, some were shared, I think. There was a beautiful dining room and hall and everything else. It's still there today, and that was our sort of third unit spot. I'd not long moved into the London Hospital medical students hostel when the Blitz started. And, of course, we were right in the centre of it. I, at that time, was learning to become a cook, because we needed cooks, because wherever we went, we had to be self-supporting. We couldn't just go and stay in hotels, so we were self-supporting. I learnt to cook. I had a very good instructor, and I think I became a very good cook for the in the sense that we were doing canteen cooking. We weren't producing cordon bleu meals. Who could, with rationing, of course. And the Blitz came upon us, so we did our stint of fire watching, and that was an incredible time, because we could go up on the roof of the hostel, and you could see the planes coming in. We'd actually see the bombs being dropped, and see the fires started. You could see right over to St Paul's. I remember seeing the flames around St Paul's. This was incredible, and we thought, what a lot of nonsense this all is. What is it all for? However. As a result of that, of course, we had a lot more work to do in the East End of London than we ever thought we would have, and we formed groups of people who'd go out to air raid hostels and help the air raid wardens marshal people in and out of them. We worked on the London Underground, because in those days this was one of the safest places to be, and people would spend night after night on the Underground stations. And